thank you all for coming tonight to hear Cory Doctorow reading from his book, For the Win. Before I introduce Cory, I want to just give a couple of thank yous so I don't forget. First of all, of course, thank One Loving Man. Thank you guys again for having us. Borderland Books, they're over there selling books, including the one that I'm holding in my hand, so please buy Cory's books. Alex Schoenfield, who has shown up today as a volunteer photographer with a really nice camera, who's going to have all sorts of pictures of this event, so thanks, Alex. Ian Carruthers, who has been at several of our events now doing videotaping for us, thank you. And Random House Books donated a bunch of, several copies, it's not a bunch, they will be hot commodities, of Little Brother on CD, the audiobook, and you can get a copy of that for free by just giving a $60 donation to EFF. So if you want to go over to the membership table at some point, while supplies last, please help yourself. So introducing Cory. I went through this whole sort of, what do I say? Do I just read the introduction? And I decided, you know what? I'm just gonna talk about my own experience with Cory. I met Cory about 10 years ago. EFF was, so when I took over as executive director of EFF, it was in July of 2000, so almost 10 years. And when we were located in this building, it was a very nice building, lots of dot-com things going on in there. And our rent was about to go up four times what it had been. So remember, this is the top of the bubble. And so things were just outrageously expensive. And besides, the space was just really not a very nice space. We had these really tall cubicle walls, so you could literally be sitting there and someone could be sitting right next to you with this big giant wall, and you wouldn't even know that that person was over there, which was not at all the kind of organization I wanted to get back to be. So we set out to get something that was more like us, the space that we're currently on in Shotwell Street. Some of you might have seen it in its early days. It used to be a paint warehouse. It was just an open space, really nasty inside. And we had this great general contractor who had once been our paralegal who built out the space for us. We had every expectation and relief that we were going to get into that space just in time for our lease that was running out on Bryant Street. And of course, it didn't work that way. And so we were about to get tossed out on the street, had no idea where we were going to go. And someone said, oh, my friend Cory has this warehouse, and he would be honored to have EFF there. And I thought, who has a warehouse that happens to be big enough to house an entire nonprofit organization and free Wi-Fi they threw in as well? So we went over to check out this warehouse space that Cory had on Utah Street. And I don't know what they were thinking. We should have a conversation about this, about what they were thinking.
It's funny this story someday.
The metal kind of decoration, and it was just this really cool space, and there were maybe four people in the entire space. It was empty. It was ridiculously empty. And so EFF actually moved into the Open Cola space, which was Cory's company at the time, his startup company at the time. And we stayed there for probably a couple of months while we waited for our new space to be ready, and then we moved in there. I don't know, was it a year or two later, that Cory was looking for a job. And I didn't really get to know Cory very well when we were using the space. He wasn't there that often. Like I said, there were only the four people, and they were traveling and doing whatever they were doing. And so about a year or two later, Cindy Cohen, who was our legal director, said, you know, my friend Cory is looking for a job, and he is really awesome. And I said, we don't have any jobs for you. And she said, let's just go to lunch with Cory, and we'll play it by ear. So we went to lunch, and by the end of the lunch, I had to make up a job. This guy was just amazing. And he never once let me down. There has never been a moment that I have not thought that this guy is amazing. He his energy, his enthusiasm, his dedication to causes. He worked for EFF for a number of years. When he moved to London, he still worked for EFF. We found funding so that we could continue to employ him while he was working in London. It was probably the worst job in the whole world. And it was good going up and being beat up by the entertainment industry all the time in the standards meetings that he was attending. But he's just always been wonderful. And it's been I'm so proud to see how great, how wonderfully received his writing is, how successful he's been, and that he's doing it, he's writing about our issues, the stuff that he cares about, that we care about. It's just been great, and I'm just really pleased to introduce Corey. I'm going to read you the back cover, so you get a little bit of the bio stuff, and it's short. Corey Doctorow is a co-editor of Boing Boing and columnist for multiple publications, including The Guardian, Locus, and Publishers Weekly. It's kind of dark up here. He was named one of the web's 25 influencers by Forbes magazine and a young global leader by the World Economic Forum, which that was news to me. I think I'm interested in hearing about that too. His award-winning novel, Little Brother, was a New York Times bestseller. He lives in London with his wife and daughter. Everybody, Corey Doctorow.
There's a fun thing about that office. We raised venture capital, and our venture capital said, we have the greatest office for you. You're going to grow really fast. You've got to take it. It's not very cheap, but you're going to love it. And after all, it's our money you're spending. It turned out it was another company they liked better than us. We bought too much office. And they thought that we could like help them survive longer if we gave money to them to sublet it. So that's how we ended up in that space. Those of you raising money for companies, keep this in mind. So, hi there. I'm on a book tour. It means I'm slightly discombobulated. This morning I had an interview with a good friend of mine in London who was writing up for a newspaper, and we were Skyping, and I forgot my camera was on and I was getting dressed. And I answered the Skype and said, oh my God, you're naked! And I reached over it like this and I turned the camera off, and then I proceeded to get dressed, carrying the laptop around, setting it down, getting dressed. And then while talking to her, doing this interview for them, just writing up the book for The Independent in London, and then I sat back down, put the laptop back down my desk, and the green light was still on over the camera. And I was like, I've just been parading around naked with you for like 10 minutes, right? She said, yeah, I don't want to say anything. So you do get a little discombobulated. It's really fun. You get to do stuff like this and see all your friends and make new friends, and it's great. So you've heard a lot about who's back there. One thing you didn't hear much about is the City Car Share connection, which I'd love to mention. City Car Share is, for those of you who don't know, it's a free kind of, or it's a novel rent by the hour kind of service that allows you to rent a car without owning a car and without going through all the hassle and hurts. And you can just sort of pick one up for the hour and run your errands, and that way you can live in a city without a car but have the benefits of cars when you need them. So anyway, my audiobook publisher, Random House, has just done this deal with them to load up their cars with samples and full audiobooks, because audiobooks and long car rides go together like peanut butter and chocolate. And so they've got some stuff here for City Car Share. They left some samplers out. And it's just really cool. Random House Audio has been surprisingly cool about the whole audiobook thing. First, they've got these great actors reading my books. But I said, you know, as a condition of this, we can only sell the books without DRM. And they're like, well, okay. You know that 90% of the market is controlled by Audible, and Audible has mandatory DRM, right? And I'm like, yeah, we can't sell through them. They're like, okay. And so that's what we've done. We even got Audible to agree to sell without DRM, but they wouldn't take the EULA off, and the EULA says all the stuff that the DRM says. It says you won't move it to a competing platform, you won't write a convert for it, you don't own it, all that other junk. And Apple refused to carry it unless it had DRM, and Audible's the only audiobook supplier for Apple. So next time someone tells you Steve Jobs doesn't like DRM, they're wrong. So that's kind of the setup. And so thank you, City Car Share, and thank you, Random House Audio. So I'm going to read you a little from For the Win, which is a book about gold farming. Gold farming is a thing people do in video games. They amass virtual wealth by doing repetitive tasks. You know, they wrestle with low-level monsters, or dig holes, or craft shirts out of sheep. And as you amass this wealth, you can then sell it on to rich players who are either too lazy or too busy to do this stuff yourself. It's formally considered cheating, But over 400,000 people do it for a living, mostly in China, but also Vietnam, Cambodia, Central and South America, and Eastern Europe. And For the Win is what happens when they form a union. It was a really fun book to write. And like all my books, it's free download. You can buy it from Borderlands folks, and there's audio too. So the scene I'm going to read to you now, I'm going to read this scene, and then I'm going to do a little talk about some of the stuff that goes into the book and goes into my work at BFF and how they converge. The scene I'm going to read to you now is one I haven't read before, so excuse me if I stumble a little. I didn't want to read the one that I've been reading as I go along, in case some of you have been at my other tour stops. And it's about the economist, the chief economist of the game, a Stanford economist who goes to work for the games hunting gold farmers. And this is the story of the hunt. And he's obsessed with something, I'll say one more word by introduction. He's obsessed with a German thing called Fingerspitzengefühl, which means fingertip feel, or the kind of intuitive sense of how the situation goes. It took the subtle Fingerspitzengefühl of a fortune teller to really predict what would happen to the game when you nerfed or buffed one character class or weapon or monster. Every change like this was watched closely by the game runners for weeks around the clock, and they tweaked the characteristics of the change from minute to minute, trying to get the game in balance. The feeds told the story. Out there in Gateland, there was a hell of a lot of activity, trades back and forth, and it worried Connor. He started to ask the other game runners if they noticed anything out of the ordinary, but then something leapt out of his feeds. There, gold runners. Gold farmers. He'd been looking for them everywhere and finding them. Gold farming had a number of signatures that you could spot with the right feed. Anytime someone logged in from a mysterious Asian IP address, walked to the nearest trading post, stripped off every scrap of armor and bling and sold it, and then took all the resulting cash and the entire contents of her guild bank and turned it over to some level one noob on a free trial account that had only been started an hour before, who, in turn, turned the money over to a series of several hundred more noobs who quickly scattered and deposited it in their own guild banks, well, that was a sure bet that you just found some gold farmer who was hacking accounts. Hell, half the time you could tell where the farmers were just by looking at the names they gave to their guilds. Real players either went for the heroic, like Savage Thunder, or the ironic, like the Nerf Herders, or the eponymous, like Jim's Raiders, but they rarely went by ASDF, 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 or, God help him, 707855DF07DE1BBB9FB3. I'm not going to read the rest of this. It's 128K registered. But as soon as he tweaked his feeds to catch them, the farmers figured out how to dodge them. The guilds got good names, the hack players started behaving more plausibly, having half-assed dialogue with the tunes they were buffing with all their goods, and the gangs that converged on any accidental motherlode in the game did a lot of realistic milling about and chatting in broken English. Increasingly, the players were logging in with prepaid cards diverted from the US over American proxies, making them indistinguishable from the lucrative American kid trade, who were apt to start playing by buying some prepaid cards along with their Cokes and gum at the convenience store. These kids had the attention spans of gnats, and if you knocked them offline after mistaking them for a gold farmer, they left and went straight to a competing world and never again showed up in your game or on your balance sheet. It was amazing how fast information spread among these creeps. Well, not amazing. After all, information spread among normal players faster than you believe, too. It was great. You hardly had to lift a finger or spend a penny on marketing when you released some new elite items or unveiled a new world. The players would talk it up for you, spreading the word at the speed of gossip. And the same jungle telegraph ran through the farmer's underground. You could see it at work. And there were more of them, a little guild of 20, all grinding and grinding the same campaign. They were fresh characters created 2 days before, and they'd been created by players who knew what they were doing. It was the perfect balance between rezzers and tanks and casters, a good mix of AoE and melee weapons. They leveled damn fast. He pulled up some forensics on the tunes, felt his fingertips and gefühl tingle as the game guttered like a flame in the breeze. He'd installed forensics packages over the howls of protest from the admin team, who'd shown him chart after chart about what running this kind of history he wanted to see would do to server performance. He'd gotten his forensics, but only after promising to use them sparingly. And there it was. The players had leveled each other by going PvP, player versus player, going to a PvP, player versus player tournament area, and repeatedly killing one another. As soon as one of them dinged up a level, he would stand undefended and let the other player kill him quickly. The game gave mega points for killing a higher level player. Once two players did, they switched places and laddered, one after the other, up to heights that normal players would take forever to attain. The campaign they were running was simple, scrounging a mix of earth fairy wings and certain mushroom caps, giving them over to a potion master who would pay them in gold. It wasn't anything special, and it was just a little below their levels, but when he charted out the returns in gold and experience per hour, he saw that someone had carelessly crafted a mission that would pay out nearly triple what the regular campaign was supposed to deliver. He shook his head. How the hell did they figure this stuff out? You'd need to chart every single little finicky mission in the game, and there were tens of thousands of missions created by designers who used software to spin a basic scenario into hundreds of variants. And there they were, happily collecting their mushroom caps and killing the brown fairies and plucking their wings. Every now and again, they happen on a bigger monster that wandered into their aggro zone, and they dispatch it with cool ease. His finger trembled over the macro that would suspend their accounts and boot them off the server. It didn't move. He admired them. That was the problem. They were doing something efficiently, quietly, and well, with a minimum of fuss. They understood the game nearly as well as he did, without the benefit of Command Central and its many feeds. He logged in. He picked an app he buffed up to level 43, halfway up the ladder to maximum, which was 90. Regulus was an elf healer, tall and whip thin, with a huge rucksack bulging with herbs and potions. He was a nominal member of one of the mid-sized player guilds, one of the ones that would accept any player for a small fee, which offered training courses, guild banking, scheduled events, all with the glad sanction of Coca-Cola. They were the right sort of people. Hello! 2 months before, the players would have kept on running their mission, blithely ignoring him. But that was one of the telltales the feeds looked for to pick out the farmers. Instead, these tunes all waved at him and did little emotes, some of which were quite good custom jobs, including dance moves, elaborate mime, and other gestures. If his feeds hadn't picked these jokers out as farmers, he'd have pegged them as hardcore players. But they hadn't actually spoken or chatted him anything. They were almost certainly Chinese, and English would be hard for them. Do you want a group? He offered them a really plum quest, one that had a crazy high gold and experience reward for a relatively nearby objective, retrieving Valen's runes from a deep cave that they'd have to fight their way into, killing a bunch of gimpy dwarves and a couple of decent bosses on the way. The quest was chained to one that led to a fight with Fenrir Sulfur, they're all Icelandic words, I'm not very good with them, one of the biggest bosses in Svartalfheim Warriors, a mega boss that you needed a huge party to take down, but which rewarded you with enormous treasure. The whole thing was farmer bait, and he cooked up specifically for this kind of mission. After a decent interval, short but long enough for the players to be puzzling through a machine translation of the quest text, they gladly joined, sending simple thanks over text. He pretended he saw nothing weird about their silence as they progressed towards the objective, but in the meantime, he concentrated on observing them closely, trying to picture them around a table in a smoky cafe in China or Vietnam or Cambodia or Malaysia. 20 skinny boys with oily hair and zits, cigarettes in the corners of their mouths, squinting around the curl of smoke. Maybe there were more than one place, in two or even three groups. They almost certainly had some kind of back channel, be it voice, text, or simply shouting at each other over the table, because they moved with good coordination, but with enough individualism that it seemed unlikely that this was just one guy running 20 bots. Where are you from? He had to be aware that they were probably trying to figure out if he was from the game, and if he made things too easy for them, he might tip them off. One player, an ogre caster with a huge club and a bandolier of mystic skulls etched with runes, replied, "We're Chinese, hope that's okay with you." This was more frank than he'd expected. Other groups he'd approached with the same gimmick had been much more closed-lipped, claiming to be from unlikely places in the Midwest like Sioux Falls, places that seem to have been chosen randomly by clicking on a map of the USA. "China," he typed. You have pretty good English then. The ogre, Prince Simon, according to his stats, emoted a little bow. "I studied in school. My guildies aren't the same good." Connor thought about who he was pretending to be, a young player in a big American city like LA. What would he say to these people? "Is it late there?" Yes, after dinner. We always play after dinner. Sounds like a lot of fun. I wish I had a big group of friends who were free after dinner. It's always homework, homework, homework. Connor's fictional persona was sharpening up for him now. A lonely high school kid in La Jolla or San Diego, somewhere on the ocean, somewhere white and middle class and isolated, somewhere without sidewalks. The kind of kid who might come across a plum quest like Valen's Runes and have to go and round up a group of strangers to run it with him. It's a good time, the ogre said, a pause. My friend wants to know what you're studying. His persona floated an answer into his head. I'm about to graduate. I've applied for civil engineering at a couple of schools. Hope I get in. The ogre said, I was a civil engineer before I left home. I designed bridges, 5 bridges, for a high-speed train system. Connor mentally revised his image of the boys into young men, adults. When did you leave home? 2 years. No more work. I will go home soon, I think. I have a family there, a little son, only 3. The ogre messaged him an image. A grinning Chinese boy in a sailor suit, toothy, holding a drippy ice cream cone like a baton, waving it like a conductor. Connor's fictional 17-year-old didn't have any reaction to the picture, but his 36-year-old self did. A father leaving his son behind, plunging off to find work. Connor hadn't ever had to support someone, but he thought about it a lot. In Connor's world, where people's motives were governed by envy and fear, the picture of this baby was seismic. An earthquake shaking things up and making the furnishings fall to the floor and shatter. He struggled to find his character. Cute! You must miss him. A lot. It's like being in the army. I will do this for a few years, then go home. What a world! Here was the civil engineer, accomplished in love, a father, living far away, working all day to amass virtual treasures, playing cat and mouse with Connor and his people. So what advice do you have for someone going into civil engineering? The ogre emoted a big laugh. Don't try to find work in China. So that's the reading. So I travel around a lot and I get a lot of talks about copyright, and I stand up and I give this rant. It goes something like this. You know, creativity is important and it's ill served by locking up knowledge, and there's some collateral damage when you do it, and so on and so forth, and DRM is dumb, and there are better business models than, you know, suing people, etc., etc., etc. But I've been saying this for 10 years now, and I've come to realize that it's all a little parochial. Here's what I mean by parochial. I once heard the head of the British Phonographic Institute, which is like the UK equivalent of the RIA, give a talk. Sorry, we'll wait for this to go by. Excellent. I once heard him give a talk about the future of technology, and he was addressing a kind of inter-industry group, and he was like, you people from all your other industries, you think that we're crazy over here in the record industry. You think that, you know, we sued all of these people, and it's because we're completely incapable of coming to grips with technology. You just wait. 3D printers are coming, and every one of you who relies on, like, trademarks and patents, you're all going to be where we are, suing people over what they're printing on their desktop fabs. And a friend of mine afterwards, he said, that was pretty, you know, interesting, like clued in, you know, technologically. Now someone from the record industry talking about 3D printers. And I said, yeah, but he thinks the major effect of the 3D printer is going to be trademark violation, right? That's, you know, like, what about printing AK-47s, right? How parochial can you get? That's like saying, oh, the railroad is coming, and all those guys who stitch the leather oat bags for the horses, they're all going to be out of work. It's true, but it's hardly the major impact of the railroad. So that's what I mean by parochial. So as much as I think that culture is important and creativity and participation are good for it, the major problem with copyright isn't what it's doing to culture. It's what it's doing to every single sphere of human endeavor, from civic engagement and education to our family life. It's because everything we do on the internet is affected by copyright, and increasingly, we do everything on the internet. So let's look at this from the entertainment industry's point of view. What makes the internet a problem? Well, first, anyone can use it, even bad guys, even people who they don't like, even people who've done bad things, even people who've been convicted of copyright infringement. You don't need a driving license to use the internet. IP addresses correspond to whole groups of users, not one user. There's no way to uniquely identify a user over the internet who doesn't want to be identified, who takes even rudimentary steps, notwithstanding EFF's excellent work on browser fingerprinting. And as a result, a certain degree of anonymity is available to all comers. And then the next problem is that geocoding is really hard to do when it's adversarial. I mean, you know, it's really easy for Google to figure out where I am when I want Google to know where I am because I want to know what the weather is where I am or find local search results. But if I choose to hide that from Google, it's really hard for Google to figure it out. You know, whenever I use a great VPN service when I'm on untrusted networks called iPredator that was developed by Pirate Bay, and it's in Sweden. So every time I'm using that and I log in and do a Google search, I have a bunch of ads for services in Linköping, Sweden, right? So Google doesn't know where I am. It's really easy to fool Google about where you are. The next problem is that endpoints are user configurable. It's impossible for someone who's transmitting content or software or a message to stipulate what kind of software the other side must use. I mean, they can send a message that says, you know, are you Internet Explorer? And your copy of Firefox can say, why, yes, I am a copy of Internet Explorer. And they really can't tell the difference. You know, so this has all kinds of consequences. Like we have this imaginary thing called a stream, right? There is no such thing as a stream. There's just a download that you believe the client on the other end is going to discard the bits from, right? But it's still, it's not like you're not making a copy. You know, sometimes you'll hear people in the entertainment industry say, well, we've got one price for a stream and another price for a download. I'm not sure how they think the stream arrives at your computer if not by downloading. I mean, it's not like there's a cunning system of mirrors that transmits it to you without making a copy, right? It's a copy. And so a stream only exists in its kind of, you know, abstract form, if you can configure the endpoint, if you can make sure that the endpoint is receiving the stream and then throwing away the bits as they come in. Every transaction on the net is a copy. And then the next problem is that there are many places that can host content. There's not just like one central repository that gathers all this stuff. And as a result, if you want to stop a copy of some piece of information from, you know, appearing in places on the internet, you need to watch all of them, and you need to watch them all the time, and try and find, you know, this rogue content that you're looking for. And routing around the blocks is therefore easy, right? You might set up a national block like we just had proposed in the United Kingdom with the Digital Economy Act, or you might have a local block through your university or your company or even, you know, airports and uni Wi-Fi and so on. But it's really easy to route around them. Again, you know, things like iPredator or VPNs. Everywhere I go to schools and I ask them about what they do about content blocking because the Communications Decency Act makes all the schools and libraries block and censor their networks. And you know, this doesn't work, right? There's like no boiler room full of prudes big enough to look at all the web pages on the internet and separate the naughty ones and the nice ones. So, you know, there's lots of reasons that kids and teachers need to get around it, and they find it trivial to do. As someone in this room once said, the internet interprets censorship as damage and writes around it. So it's interesting to note that every one of these problems overlaps with the same problems that have been identified by repressive governments like those in China and Syria and so on, that this internet agenda of eliminating anonymity, of limiting the number of places that you can get content from, of establishing network blocks, of uniquely identifying internet users, all of that stuff is identical with the agenda of, say, you know, the Politburo and its designs for the Great Firewall of China. They really have this, they've come to the same place from a different direction. Now, these are not like minor problems for the entertainment industry. As it is presently construed, these are non-negotiable bugs. They cannot be overcome in the current configuration of the entertainment industry, which is not to say that they can't be changed, that the entertainment industry can't be changed, but they can't go on the way they are with a network like this. So imagine what would happen if instead of the entertainment industry changing, they change the internet, which is what they're trying to do, which is what EFF has been fighting. So every user would be affirmatively identified, and you would need permission to use the internet. So in fact, you'll often hear them say this kind of in code. They'll say things like, you need a driver's license to operate a car. Why should you be able to drive down the information superhighway without a driver's license? This is where the information superhighway metaphor has gone to die. It's the last place where anyone will say it with a straight face. So if that were the case, it would be very easy for governments, for news entities, and for other agencies to discriminate against people based on their nationality or their location or their economic status, which is, I think, an increasing problem where you have ad-supported services where they might just block out neighborhoods or individuals on the basis that they're not interesting enough to their advertisers to waste money on. So listen for the entertainment industry. If you want to see this emerging in their agenda, listen to the entertainment industry to talk about how we have great functional sensor walls in many countries to block child porn. You know, this is the full horseman of the apocalypse. Child pornographers, the mafia, terrorists, and pirates. And you can invoke them to justify any repressive measure on the internet. And in the UK, where we've got this new censor wall rule that they're putting up around the country, they say, well, of course, we know that it works because we've been using it to block child porn. And it's not just them that say it. Bono, you know, the guy from U2, gave a talk, wrote an editorial in the New York Times last year in which he said, of course we can solve piracy, we just need to use the same blocking technology that the Chinese government uses in all of our networks. Right? As some people have wanted to say, we know you love freedom, Bono, we just wish you'd share. So what else would happen if the entertainment industry solved these problems? Well, you wouldn't be able to install any old software on your computer. You'd just be able to run approved code. It would look a lot like an iPad, right? Where you could only run code that you had guaranteed to some regulator or some corporate cartel that you wouldn't gore their ox, that you wouldn't do anything that upset them. And like everything that we use today fails that test. Right. If Tim Berners-Lee had been sat at his desk in CERN in 1988 and had gone to the entertainment industry and said, I want to invent this thing called the web, and it's going to let anyone click on any link and download anything, and there's not going to be any way to find all the things that are on the network and so on, this would not have passed muster on this test. I beg your pardon? Straighten the mic. That's part of a larger pattern of this idea of being able to stipulate what kind of software you can install on the end nodes to make things like streaming a reality. And we're seeing that encroach more and more as people describe or try to recast the general purpose computer as an appliance. But it's not really an appliance the way that we understand appliances. My friend Joel Johnson wrote an editorial chastising me for what I said about the iPad when I criticized the iPad for being a lockdown platform. He said, you know, you can't build things with your dishwasher either. It's an appliance. But no one's ever made a dishwasher where the manufacturer got to stipulate what kind of plates you could put in it. No one's ever made a toaster where you could only buy the bread that the toaster company approved. And no one's ever made a dishwasher or a toaster where making a dish or a piece of toast that would fit in one of those machines was illegal. So we already see this happening in things like set-top boxes, we see it happening in these mobile devices, we see it happening in phones, and we see it encroaching from all sides, this idea that you can configure and own the endpoints. And one thing that's a natural consequence of this is that it freezes out free and open source software. Because if the reason that you want to control the endpoints is you don't want the user to install or run software that does something that undoes the motivation of some remote party, you can't afford to have them using open source software that they can modify to their will. You know, if the software says in its code, I'm going to throw away all the bits after I receive the stream, and all the user has to do is change the code so it says, no, I won't, it's defeated the whole purpose. And so that's a major encroachment, not just on freedom, but on an entire new industrial mode of production that has seen all kinds of enormous benefits and been a source of innovation and a source of access to low-cost tools for all kinds of people. Someone let that guy ignore it? So we've already seen this happen in the UK. The BBC has done it already. They just locked down the iPlayer, which is their video on demand tool, and they just petitioned Ofcom, the FCC equivalent, for the regulatory authority to add DRM to their broadcasts so that they can stipulate all the technology that you can use to receive broadcasts. In that world, only big companies can really contribute to the software ecosystem, because only big companies are impedance matched with the FCC and with other big regulators to go in and send guys in suits to negotiate whether or not their technology can find its way into the field. And if you're just like two people in a garage in Palo Alto, you don't really have the wherewithal to send someone to the Hill and negotiate for permission from the Politburo to add your software to the ecosystem. And in fact, when the IP czar, the new IP enforcement coordinator, the White House has appointed Victoria Espinel, put out a call for proposals on how America should enforce copyright, one of the things that the entertainment industry filed, and Richard back there wrote a great paper about this for EFF's website, they proposed that everyone should install spyware on their computers that looked for things that might be infringing and deleted them automatically, the way that we install software in our computers that looks for viruses and deletes it automatically. And they again sort of blindly asserted that because this was possible with viruses, it would be possible with copyright too. Of course, it's not possible with viruses, right? McAfee's just settling this huge lawsuit because periodically they mistake random pieces of the operating system for a virus and break your computer. And viruses are a lot easier to distinguish from non-viruses than copyrighted works that are infringing are to distinguish from copyrighted works or other works that aren't infringing. I mean, usually we need things like Supreme Court judges to do that, not algorithms hacked up by half-assed, you know, arms merchants to the copyright wars. What if we solved the problem that there were too many ways to host content? Well, we already see that happening too. Viacom has said that Google should have an affirmative duty to police all the material that gets uploaded to YouTube, right? That's something like 29 hours a minute now of material and growing fast. There aren't enough lawyer hours remaining between now and the heat death of the universe to review all of that material in real time. So what does that mean? Well, it means that if you want to make that stuff run, if you want to make a service like YouTube work, you're going to have to throttle the stuff that comes in. You're going to have to do what they do on cable television, right? And that's that if you want to put something into the media sphere, your lawyers meet with their lawyers and you negotiate together and you write out all kinds of warranties and representations that you're not infringing, and you get insurance and you indemnify, and then and only then your material can see the light of day. And this doesn't seem very onerous if you're the kind of organization that's devoted its life to doing this, right? But there's a reason that you don't see a lot of cable television stations operated by parents who run Little League games. There's a reason you don't see them run by grassroots political campaigns. There's a reason you don't see them run by people who are starting scrappy little community kitchens or running their own little photo sharing experiments or getting their guild together to play World of Warcraft. And that's because those organizations are not impedance matched to send lawyers to negotiate and indemnify for permission to put content on the network. It would mean, if we solve this problem of too many ways to get content on the internet, that whistleblower sites like WikiLeaks would vanish. And it would mean that things like anonymous videos of cops beating up protesters would never find their way into the network. Establishing a website would be complex and expensive, and it would involve making sure that your ISP's lawyers signed off on it. So what would happen if they solved the problem of there being too many ways to get around content blocks? Preventing proxies from rerouting content over the internet is technically very challenging to the point where you might as well call it impossible. It's really baked into the fundamental architecture of the internet. But there are other ways to stop this technology from arising, and that's basically to use intimidation to make it happen. The way that we've seen with lawsuits over copyright and tool makers, where these enormous judgments that come back against people who made tools that allow for file sharing have scared off all venture capital, have scared off anyone who might list them in a public exchange, and have really kept these firms from entering the market. So again, we see that too, where there are lawsuits against people who host content and lawsuits against people who operate proxies that are intended to scare off someone else who might want to do it. The message is, running a proxy may be possible, but it's not good for your health. So already, you know, in Germany, there have been some incursions here where people who run open proxies or Tor nodes have been held responsible for what other people do with their proxies. We just saw a lawsuit in Germany where the entertainment industry sued someone for leaving their wireless network open because someone else used it to download infringing material, and that's just coming in the UK as well. So limiting bad guys from using the net means controlling who may or may not use it. It means controlling who gets to use the network and who doesn't, and giving that authority to rights holder groups, to corporate cartels, to self-interested bodies who don't really care about the underlying uses of the internet or the new uses of the internet. They really just care about what you're doing with Police Academy sequels. Again, we've seen this start to emerge in the agenda as well with the so-called three strikes rules that say if you're accused without conviction of three acts of copyright infringement, we take away your internet access. And not just you, but everyone else who shares your network know that that is often an entire family. And one of the things that we know is that for everybody, the internet is very important, but especially for the most vulnerable and economically marginal people, households that have the internet versus households that don't have better nutrition, their kids get better grades, they're more socially mobile, they don't pay as much for their home bills, they can pay their bills online and it costs them less. They have more money, they find better jobs. So when you take away someone's internet, you take away all of that, and that's just passed in the UK, it's just passed in France, it's back on the agenda in New Zealand, it's back on the agenda in Canada, and it's back on the agenda here, thanks to the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, a secretive copyright treaty being negotiated among the world's rich countries without any public scrutiny. They've finally released one draft, but they're not going to tell you how it goes. No activists are allowed in the room. Poor countries especially aren't allowed in the room. The idea here is that this will be passed. And then poor countries will be arm-twisted into bringing it on, even though they didn't have a chance to help negotiate it, because they'll need it as a condition of other trade agreements with the US and with a club of rich countries. The Obama administration's trade representative has said that releasing the details of this negotiation would violate national security, that there's a national security interest in keeping this stuff secret. And they've also intimated that they would bring this into law by executive decree without congressional debate. So that's coming here soon, too. So this is the non-parochial face of the copyright. This is not just a brush war over culture. It's not just about who gets to make videos and put them on YouTube. This is about which families will enjoy access to the largest library of human creativity ever assembled. It's about whose kids will get to go to college. So every kid's an infringer, right? But some kids end up in real trouble when they infringe, and some kids just get a stern talking to, like Edgar Bronfman Jr., who runs Warner Music, who admitted that his son had downloaded music and that he paid the consequences. I don't know what consequences he paid, but for most families whose kids get caught downloading music, the consequence is your entire life savings. Well, the Bronfman Empire is quite big because, you know, they made a lot of money as drug smugglers. They used to run booze into America. They're Canadians like me. They used to run booze into America during Prohibition. And so they got this enormous narcotics fortune. Apparently, they haven't had to turn that over to the RIAA. This is about who gets to contact their members of Congress and maybe even vote as e-voting creeps in, which is another can of worms we'll get into some other benefit talk for EFF. It's about who'll get to build an addition to their house or add something to their roof, because increasingly local governments that are cash-strapped are eliminating paper forms, right? When you get kicked off the internet, you can't change the way your house is configured. You can't apply for permission to extend your garden one foot towards your driveway. All of that stuff gets locked out too. This is about who gets to speak and who will get to participate in the democratic discourse. So yeah, I care about finding copy-friendly business models because I'm a writer and it's nice that I earn a living and I'm glad that I found a way to do it. It's great, you know, you can buy my books, it's lovely. But this is bigger than the story of how we pay artists or when we'll pay artists. This is about whether the values embodied by the Enlightenment, by democracy, by a free and open and fair society will survive into the information age, into the 21st century. This is about whether unfettered access to knowledge, the right to work with your neighbors, the right to enter the realms of commerce or social enterprise, the right to social mobility and political discourse will be open to one and all, or will be reserved to those whose modes of expression and endeavor don't inadvertently threaten Bono's next million. So there's a parochial response to this, right? When you say this to the entertainment industry, they go, oh yeah, you just want to steal. You know, I don't give a crap about mainstream Hollywood entertainment. It's lovely. I enjoy watching robots throw buildings at each other as much as the next guy. But I've been editing Boing Boing now for 10 years, and there's so much amazing, wonderful things that people make when you give them access to tools, ideas, and communities, that if they all disappeared tomorrow, I wouldn't miss them. You know, cathedrals were great, but when the Protestant Reformation made it impossible to take 3 generations of artisans and turn them to building enormous buildings, it's not like religion ended, right? We still found lots of ways to do cool stuff together. They'll say things like, the Wild West days are over. The internet used to be a frontier, hence Electronic Frontier Foundation. But now it's a civilized place and needs civilizing laws. And it's true that every frontier town eventually turns into a city, but that's not what we're arguing about. We're arguing about whether the electronic frontier will become a police state. Or they'll say, it's only the internet, why are you so upset? And this is the biggest tell of all. Saying it's only the internet is like saying it's only literacy, or it's only democracy, or it's only free speech. If you have to ask, you'll never understand what's the big deal about it only being the internet. So this war isn't ending, it's just getting started. You're gonna be asked to choose sides, and they'll try to lure you in by telling you that they just wanna add a little control to our systems and networks. It's like saying we only wanna make you a little bit pregnant. If you care about the core values of a free democratic society, you can't be on the side of breaking the internet, taking away anonymity, free speech, and a borderless world. If you care about that stuff, you need to work for it tirelessly and not buy into the excuses and not buy into the BS. Supporting EFF is a great way to do that. You've all done that tonight. I hope you're all members of EFF, that you are part of the Action Center, that you send in notes to your Congress critters when that happened. But also tackling this with your friends and neighbors, not letting lazy habits of thought lure you into going, well, it's shiny and I'm only going to use it for a couple of years. It's not going to matter if it's all crippled up with DRM. Not supporting those business models is a big way that you can help too. So thank you all very much for coming. And you know, I'll take some questions now, and then I'll be around. I can sign your books and chat. It's so nice to see so many of you people tonight. So thank you. The gentleman in the stylish EFF NSA shirt.
President, what are your thoughts on HTML5 video thing? It's obviously there's big news today with the WebM thing, but aside from that, a lot of people talk about patents and you know, the various terms of licensing, but I think the bigger issue is that Flash lets people have videos have ads. And if you have open source software, you can't really require people to watch ads
for
the videos.
Right. So there was apparently some news about HTML5. I've spent the entire day in high schools talking to school groups, so I know nothing about the news about HTML5.
Google
open
source.
Google open source onto. That's cool. Also started by Canadians, strangely enough. We're everywhere like serial killers. We look just like everybody else. If you have open video that isn't DRM crippled, you can't add ads to it. Well, you know, here's the thing. I think if you have DRM crippled video, you can add ads to it, but it's not like that has any technical nexus with people figuring out how to remove the ads, right? If you want, like, I run a website that's ad supported, and we've got a lot of ads on it, and we're pretty tech savvy, so a lot of our users use ad blockers, and we can't force them not to. The only way that we can try and get them not to block our ads is on the one hand trying not to be too obnoxious about it, which is a fine line, we walk it. And the other thing is by having a social contract, right? So it's something that's not just commerce, but also community. And I think that's really the only way that any of this stuff can work. Social contracts are a lot more powerful than technological locks. We tend, because we've got a hammer, we tend to treat everything like a nail. So we go, all right, well, we need to make sure people watch ads. How can we lock ads to the video? But you know, locks are really only as good as the society around them. As they're only as good as the degree to which you and your neighbors trust each other and work together and are kind of all on the same side, right? The reason your neighbors can burgle your house today is because there's a lock on the door. I mean, you and I are clever people. We can think of 25 ways to get into your house even though the front door is locked. The reason they didn't break into your house is because you've got a social contract with them. And so this is one of the things that I love about Creative Commons is that in the CC movement, we tend to think everybody reads the license. Most people don't read the license, right? This is the funny thing when you hear the entertainment industry say, all we need to do is educate the general public about copyright. You know, I come from the copyright world where there's like four basic terms in some combinatorial permutation, and nobody knows what they mean. And I don't mean like commercial, non-commercial, what's commercial, what isn't, those hard problems. I mean like the easy problems, like if it's Creative Commons, it's in the public domain, right? Or if it's Creative Commons, it means that you can share it, but not with more than like 9 people. It's like listening to 12-year-olds discuss sex, right? Like, I think you get pregnant from swimming in a swimming pool with people from the opposite sex, you know? Like just really like, you know, and that's as it should be, because copyright's a spruce. You shouldn't have to understand it unless you're a lawyer. And you know, that's really the bigger problem. But I think that what Creative Commons does for me is not that it convinces a lot of 12-year-olds to read licenses and understand them. I think that what it does is it conveys another message, which is that we're all reasonable people, let's not try to screw each other over. And that's way more powerful than any license stricture will ever be.
So I guess I didn't really phrase my question.
Okay.
Quite right. Do you think the entertainment industry will actually start using
HTML5? Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. The entertainment industry turns out to be like really easy to manipulate in some important ways, right? Brewster Kahle, who started the Internet Archive out of the Presidio, he's got this great story. He tells about a packaged software heyday in the 80s when Microsoft was selling a lot of tools to stop people from pirating their software. And those tools also locked your software to their platform. And at a certain point, they had like 95% market share. And then they started to just destroy vendors that had been part of their platform for a long time. So in Toronto, we had Delrina that made Delrina Fax, right? Microsoft Windows 95 comes out. It's got Fax bundled in. No one ever buys another copy of Delrina Fax again. It doesn't matter how much DRM they put in the software. The fact that there's a free copy that came with your OS meant that it was never going to happen. The way Brewster tells it, it's like Microsoft was going, look over here, pirates, 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 and nobody saw the knife in the other hand. And it turns out that this is really easy to do in the entertainment industry, right? You can go, look over here, pirates, pirates, pirates. Let me put DRM on the music in the iTunes store. And then, once we've got total lock-in, you'll find out that you can't negotiate the price of music, that it's all 99 cents, and if you don't like it, you can take a hike, and you've got to be willing to believe that your customers will abandon billions of dollars in investment in music. And so now we can take the DRM off, because in aggregate, there's billions of dollars worth of sunk costs that would prevent a switch sitting in there. And we'll keep DRM and all the other things where there's still contentious, like audiobooks and video and games and iPad software and so on. And we'll only remove that once we've got locked in there too, right? It turns out that they're really gullible. They'll buy into this. If you tell them that there's a boogeyman at the door, they will buy like magic anti-boogeyman charms that secondary effects that allow you to corner their market. I talked about Edgar Bronfman Jr. before, so I like the Bronfman family's little parable about what happens to negotiating power with DRM. Edgar Bronfman Sr. ran Universal, very powerful guy. When he quit, he decided that for kicks, he would get Nazi gold back from the Swiss, right? So this is like someone who has a lot of negotiating juice, right? You know, it's like, Nazi gold, they have no Nazi gold, silly person, you're speaking some German, you speak Italian, I'm a cuckoo clock, and he got it all back, right? Edgar Bronfman Jr., he does the deal with Apple. A couple of years later, he goes, you know, there's some songs I'd like to charge 50 cents for and some I'd like to charge $1.25 for. And Steve Jobs says, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out, right? So talk about a fall in negotiating power, and that's all down to the DRM. It's the DRM that locked them in. So I think that maybe we can figure out ways to trick the credulous bullies of the entertainment industry into jumping on to HTML5. I wouldn't put it past them. Yeah?
So this book's kind of similar to Andes Game, that short story.
Uh-huh.
How is this book informed by that short story?
So I wrote this short story called Andes Game in 2004 after reading a story on Slashdot about the first gold farms in Mexico. In fact, it looks like maybe that story was BS, like the guy who gave the presentation about it was making it up. But it got people really excited and talking about it. And I wrote about gold farming as though it were being invented in the future, as though I hadn't just read about it on Slashdot, which is a little trick I call predicting the present. And so what happened was that over the next couple of years, as people started to do real gold farming, it grew and people came up with the name gold farming, which didn't exist when Andes Game came out. People would send me excited emails with stories about gold farming, going, oh my god, you predicted this, right? Which is great, it made me feel clever, but it had the side effect of me having a constant stream of interesting and useful information about gold farming kind of rolling over my transom, which is how I kind of got to the point where I said, hey, there's a novel here, and that's how I wrote the book. Yeah?
Do you think the entertainment industry is current for is going to survive like the next 10 years with the internet if they don't?
Right. Will the entertainment industry survive if they don't change drastically? I used to be a lot more sanguine about this. Now that they're winning some pretty important victories, I'm not so sure. I think they may dig in for a little while longer. I mean, really, I think from the in terms of those companies, the big problem isn't that they don't know that they have to change eventually. It's that if you're a top exec there, there's lots of things that you might do, most of which would cost you the business and be really wrong. And so your best strategy is to do nothing until you retire, because then you're not the guy who crashed Universal, right? If you're a junior exec there, and that's what the strategy is, you're gonna end up in a bread line, because if they don't do something, they will eventually come a cropper. So I think that there's that tension within those businesses. The other thing that I think we've got on our side is that the longer the internet's around, the more we come to appreciate that it's not just a way to like get mildly diverting videos of hamsters, or to, you know, take top 40 music without paying for it, it's a way to do everything, right? It's, and so, you know, it used to be that you had to be like a weirdo visionary, you know, EFF person to go, this internet thing is more important than, you know, a couple, than the alt hierarchy. Now there's lots and lots and lots of people who are like, wow, I'm not really a technical person, but the internet's how I make my living. Or I'm not really a technical person, but the internet is how I stay in touch with my family. Or I'm not really a technical person, but the internet is how I cope with my health problems. And as that goes on, the number of people who are naturally on our side grows. You in the back, maybe. Yeah? Yeah, no, you? So if the traditional business models fail, fewer people will make art. Yeah, I don't think that that's true. I mean, for one thing, the vast majority of people who've ever tried to make art didn't get a deal from one of the majors, and the ones that did didn't make very much money from it, right? So, you know, like on its face, that's untrue, right? If the only reason people ever made art was because they would get a deal with the majors, then the fact that 99% of the people who ever tried to pitch a movie or ever tried to make it big as a band never got one would suggest that all those people would give up in discouragement. They haven't, right? They still make stuff. Maybe, you know, people play the lottery even though almost no one wins it. So maybe the lottery ticket does hold out some hope. But we have a lot of history of really intense and wonderful creativity that predates the modern copyright industry that suggests that that's a lie. And we also have all the creativity that's arisen since the internet came along that suggested that sort of latent there in the population was the desire to create and collaborate. You know, the 29 hours of video a minute in YouTube and more viewers than television has now tells you that this is just not true on its face. So I often hear writers say, you know, because I work in that circle, I hear writers say, if it wasn't for, you know, the right to exclusively control my works, I wouldn't write. And, you know, in my, I think they're lying. Like, when we actually sit around and talk about it, they say, really? You know, the only thing that could get me to stop writing is if you broke all my fingers. Because, you know, if you're getting into writing to earn a living at it, you're crazy, right? Because most people will never earn a living at writing. That's not because of the internet, that's just because art is irrational. There's more people who make it than want to buy it. And so most people who make it have no hope of making a living. I teach, you know, writing to students all the time. And one of the most important things that I teach them that was taught to me was how to have a day job and write at the same time. You had a question.
You mentioned the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, did I understand you correctly that in today's information society we should try to defend and protect the values generated by the Enlightenment? And yes, are you familiar with movements that question those values, came out of the Enlightenment?
Such as?
Romanticism.
Oh, should we defend romanticism? You know, that's should we defend romanticism instead of the Enlightenment? That's a little too abstract. Well, let's talk about that later. It's I don't know enough about romanticism to have that debate with you.
Okay, the first question,
did I
understand it correctly?
Yes, that I do think we should defend Enlightenment values. That, you know, as opposed to like having alchemy where everyone discovers for himself that drinking mercury is a bad idea, we should share our results. All right, maybe, how are we doing for time? Maybe one more question? Does that sound good? You guys have all been very patient. Yeah, make a good one.
I'll try.
Okay.
More years ago than I care to think, I was privileged to hear Werner Binga talk about the concept of universal law enforcement.
Uh-huh.
With transistor counts, you could embed law enforcement in different devices. At the time, things were ungodly slow. We had other concerns. A couple of years ago, I get a digital cable box. I go to hook up my Dell LCD monitor, and I can't use it because it doesn't do HDMI and copy protection.
Right.
Do you see this coming into focus as a threat, particularly with the new pushes on different legal regimes for restricting access to content?
Yeah, well, we start to embed self-enforcing laws in our devices. I think we will. I think we are, right? As you said, you've got this in your cable device. We've got it increasingly in mobile devices and in our OSs, right? It's coming not just at the hardware, but the software level. And I think you're right. I think that's the big threat right now is that the general purpose PC is being closed down not because it's more convenient. That's just the kind of cover story. Oh, look, you know, finally it's convenient. My mom can use it. I know why everyone thinks their moms are so dumb. You know, my mom's like an early adopter, who's got a PhD, and like, you know, she's better at a lot of technology than I am, you know. So, oh, finally, we're making something my mom can use, and that's why we've taken out all the freedom. You know, open isn't the opposite of elegant, right? There's lots of things that are both open and elegant. And, you know, the free software world abounds with these. My favorite example, this is kind of my example du jour, because it really delighted me. I run Ubuntu on my laptops, and I've had occasion, for various reasons, to have a lot of different USB keys that do 3G modem stuff. And if you actually get the drivers from the company, they're crazy. They put this big splash screen up when you're connecting to the internet. Now connecting you with Verizon, right? Like it's like a special, amazing thing that they figured out how to like get your computer onto the internet, right? Like that little chime that Word does when it saves a file. It's like, you know, if you're happy that you've managed to save my file, you're doing something wrong. That should just be quotidian, right? And they install this crap on your desktop, and most of it doesn't work. It's a pain in the ass and whatever. Ubuntu, you stick a 3G thing in, and I don't know if there's anyone here who works on Ubuntu Mobile, but if you are, you're a genius. So you stick a little 3G thing in, and it goes like, I've detected a 3G modem, it looks like it's probably a T-Mobile UK modem, is that right? You click yes, and it goes, okay, you're on the internet, and that's it, right? So my wife's 3G modem that her employer gives her works better on my computer without the official drivers than it works on her computer with them. So there's lots of ways in which open is not the opposite of elegant. There's lots of ways in which proprietary is synonymous with crappy and painful and obnoxious. So I think that that's the thing we have to keep reminding ourselves of. Yeah, it's nice to have, you know, a megalomaniac and a turtleneck who every now and again says, this is how it shall be. But you know, you can have a megalomaniac and a turtleneck with that, and add a checkbox that says, I'm a grown-up, I'd like to install my own software too, right? Which is the Ubuntu model. And you know, Shuttleworth is a very nice maniac in a turtleneck. Actually, mostly it's into golf collars, I think. Well, thank you all very much. There's books for sale from the Borderlands folks. There's lots of EFF swag, including that awesome Fourth Amendment tape that Brad designed. There's Brad. So you can put it around your luggage so the TSA has to violate the Fourth Amendment, cut through the Fourth Amendment with a knife in order to get in your luggage. And t-shirts, and I'm going to be around for a while, and I've got a pen. I'm not afraid to use it. So thanks.